Well, hello everyone. My guest today is a chap called William or Wilhelm or Kaiser Chilhelm from the Consequent Fry channel, which I've linked down in the show notes. He wants to talk about the issue of Russia and particularly Russia and the right and how that might look, you know, in the current moment and in years to come. And also, I mean, it's been a while since I've talked about Russia in general, so this should be interesting. Before we get going, I must mention Foundations of Shakespeare, now available on pre-order. If you have done the course, you get 50% off if you send the receipt to the publisher. And speaking of the courses, it's still January. That means it's promo code SHORJAN. I'll play this ad, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about Russia.
Sure. Sure, 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 sure. And so, sure.
Sure, Jan.
Can you command a comma like Joseph Conrad?
Sure, sure, sure,
sure, sure, and sure, Jan.
Are you magnificent in your mastery of marginalism like Murray Rothbard?
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
Are you legendary in your logical leveling of lamentable loquacity?
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
Come on down to the January sale at the Academic Agency. Promo code SHORJAN for 25% off. All this January, I got more courses than the Queen had horses.
Sure, Jan.
I got better rates than Andrew Tate's had mates.
Sure, Jan.
I got better deals than Lizzo's had meals.
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
And so, sure, 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 and so, sure, 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 and so, sure.
All right, so let's talk about Russia. One of the things that struck me when I first started reading older right-wing authors, I have in mind Oswald Spengler, Julius Evola, to some extent, Francis Parker Yockey, but also some lesser known British rightists, people like Major General Richard Hilton, A.K. Chesterton, A.K. Chesterton, and a few other key people as well. They always talked as Europeans or as Brits, okay, which is a slightly different thing, we may get into, but they always talked about being caught between two civilizational enemies, America to the West and Russia to the East. And I mean, a lot of the thing that was interesting to me about those authors is that they often talked about America as the greater threat. Because I can't remember who said it, you know, the Russians might kick your head in, but basically America will kind of rot you from the inside. You know, they'll give you a glass of poison with a smile and kind of slowly dissolve your civilization like an acid. Whereas the Russians aren't going to do that. They're just going to, like, you know, stick a gun in the back of your head. but that was always how it, and I always pictured it, like you have a kind of the two different types of enemies. It's like the Russians are like a big ogre or like a kind of a brute. That's how they're always depicted by these older authors, or, you know, an orc horde or something like that. Whereas the Americans are painted as a sneaky enemy, as a kind of swindler and a cheat, and you know, someone who'll smile in your face and stab you in the back type thing. At the moment, I think there is heightened awareness in Europe and in Britain to some extent, to a lesser extent, but I think it's happening, especially on some parts of the online right. Has to be said also in Canada and possibly in Australia too. I think there's heightened awareness and wariness of the Americans at the moment. I think people are seeing a lot of bellicose rhetoric from America, the behavior of certain MAGA chuds is starting to wind people up and so on. And so in the current framework, people are, you know, focused on America. However, rumbling in the background, you know, for years now at this point, is the threat of Russia. And I mean, it's been quite an interesting and also difficult thing to navigate. On my show and on this channel, I've always taken the view that I understood why Russia took the actions it did. I, you know, how can I put this? I kind of like never gave Ukraine a chance in that. And I, my stance was always Zelensky and friends are basically sacrificing the lives of the European, of the Ukrainian population for a NATO stratagem, right? Which to me was kind of evil. And they should have just negotiated with a much bigger neighbor in the name of realpolitik. Lots of people disagree with that. For that, I have been called and accused of being a Russian shill, right? I'm not. I have no interest. I mean, I have no contact with the Russians at all, you know. But that is, like, I am not on the same, I have not been on the same page as, for example, the mainstream media, the liberal media, NATO shills, and so on and so forth. However, I recognize, and I'll let you come in a second, I do recognize, though, that it could be part of an active strategy from the Kremlin, you know, from Moscow, to try to influence the online sphere. And there have been some relatively high-profile cases of influencers taking sizable portions of money and being found out. I forget the name of the girl now. She was an Asian girl in Canada or America. I forget her name. Was it? But that was fairly well publicized. Maybe I saw Tim Pool mentioned at some point. But that question of Russian money being around, I know, is a live thing. I'm, you know, I'm still friendly with Richard Spencer, who talks about this a lot. So I'm kind of aware of it. So I've been, you know, I don't talk about Russia that much, but it's become obvious that there is some sort of influence operation operating from the Kremlin. All right. With all that said, I've tried to set things up for you, William. I'll let you now. What do you make of all of this?
I mean, there are many, many good points over there. So I would just start with the most, with the easiest one, which is basically the American question. We talked at the RITAN 2023 and at a nice little chat there, and back then, I don't know if you remember, but back then there was the beginning of the cracks began to show between the European right and the American right, and even back then we said, well, it's always this emotional overreaction, and they just, at least the base or large portions of the base, step into every trap that is set in front of them. And it is really difficult to deal with that, because on the one side, well, America is currently the hegemon, especially in Europe. We are basically Gaul and they're Rome. There's, I mean, it's not going to change in the next 5 years or 10 years, maybe even 50 years. I don't know. It's just the situation right now. And what I really don't like is when, I mean, empire is always going to exist. I'm not an anti-imperialist or something like that. I just don't like the idea that you have like the hegemon that basically demands taxes from you, demands loyalty from you, but then punishes you by saying, well, yeah, you did this to yourself. Like, what? And this is a very, I know not everybody is like that. I lived in the United States for a while, for at least a year. I know a lot of Americans, and I like Red America in that sense. But the way the, at least the geopolitical class is acting, is, it's not a good foundation to work with. And it puts especially the right in Europe as in a really dangerous spot right now. Because inside the AfD, for the right-wing party in Germany, you had basically two, well, we say wings of the party, One was more aligned to Russia and basically influenced by Russia, and the other was more like, it's okay to be in the American Empire sphere as long as we can have like a German nation and don't import foreigners. And I certainly agree more with the it's okay to be in the empire as long as we don't have foreigners here side of the argument. And for a long time, especially with Trump, it looked like that this sphere is going somewhere. You had Vance at the security conference doing a shout out for them and everything. But right now, with the way Trump is acting, especially with the Greenland situation, it's basically taking the entire wind out of the sails of these faction and pushes on the one side the door open for the basically Russia influenced side, and on the other side it's empowering the established interests, basically the Eurocrats, to say, well, the right is just they're just some loyal dogs or whatever, we can either ban them or we don't even need to listen to them. And you see it currently with the completely astroturfed attempt of creating a European nationalism, which is based on really, it's such an obvious attempt of trying to form something out of nothing, just because they suddenly realized, well, we kind of need to reverse course within a very short time. I always see it as they're trying to reverse an oil tanker on the side on the at a basically on a dime, and it's not going to work. You have the whole momentum of the decades of anti-nationalistic or anti-white rhetoric pushing against this, and now they're trying to say, yeah, but actually we're all European. So it's a really difficult spot for everybody, but especially for the part of the right that says, well, we don't want to align completely with Russia. We don't want to basically align with the blue empire. We just want sensible economic policy. We want sensible immigration policy, which just means, deport them. And these people, which I, would consider myself as a sensible centrist, these are currently squeezed on all sides, and it's a really difficult situation.
Yeah, I mean, one of the issues that I've seen for quite a while with the European right in general, same issue in this country as well, although I always think that Britain in the European context is always closer to America for some reason that maybe it's the idea that they're the same people at the end of the day, so that old idea type thing. I don't know if you noticed that Britain always seems to be closer to the US position, although that's cracking as well. I noticed, for example, the British establishment was not on board with the Venezuela deal that Trump did. Right? They are fully 100% on board with the stuff that's happening in Iran. Right, they want like the regime change operation there, but they notably weren't on board with the Venezuela thing. They're also really, really not on board with the Greenland thing as well. So it's interesting where they're drawing their red lines. But the problem I've seen for a while in the European context is that it's quickly become obvious that that populism as a movement has been a Trojan horse for the interests of Zionism, right? And the problem is every party is going to face the Meloni problem, right? Where she made the gambit. She was going to trade off foreign policy, i.e. on all the foreign policy stuff, she can be the neocon cheerleader or lapdog, okay? Go along with all of that in exchange for the domestic peace, okay? The trouble is that as far as I can see, Meloni didn't get the domestic peace, i.e. in the bargain, she did her bit, but they didn't do their bit. She didn't get it. She still increased immigration. She still, didn't sort out lots of things. And in the end, it ended up being slop symbolic things that Maloney got. Like, I don't know, like on some a few cultural issues or, you know, around flags or whatever it was. It's been like all the trans or something. But you know what I mean? Less substantial things than the big one that all the people who voted for her care about, which is the huge amount of immigration that's gone into Italy. And that's the thing I worry about with all of these populists is that, you agree to go along with what the empire wants, thinking that you'll get the domestic peace, and then they don't give it to you.
I mean, I can't really comment on Italy. I heard stories that support this angle, and I heard other things talking good about Meloni, so I don't know where to take a position on that. But I feel like this is a real danger that either side faces. So as also the side that tries to say, well, and we have these voices inside the AfD, that say, well, then let's just invite Russia as a new hegemon. But Russia just gives you a different kind of migration, and basically it's a whole different kind of worms. And I mean, what I don't really get is it would be really, at least from my perspective, really easy for Red America, the Red Empire, to get a lot of support from Europe. Basically, we're saying, all right, you guys, you can build up your military, be prepared to use it against Russia, but you can build up strength, you can build up your industry, you can even be your, like, do some, deport foreigners or whatever, but you need to pay your imperial taxes, and, well, if you call on you on the military, basically classic imperial stuff, then we need you, and then you're going to be there. I think most European countries would accept this deal gladly because, I mean, you get a lot out of it. But nobody seems to be offering this deal, maybe because they can't, or maybe because there are too many entrenched interests. Especially with Trump, it's a huge disappointment in that sense, because, well, Trump may be America first, but Israel firster. So I don't think his donors really like the idea of especially a strong Germany or a militarily strong Germany. So they're going to use every opportunity to weaken it. And it's the question is, can you make a deal? And the bigger question is, how do you even get America to basically be loyal to their part of the deal? Because when you look at recent foreign policy, like the last 40, 50 years, every time somebody relied on the Americans, it doesn't matter if it's been in South America or in Asia or wherever, when it came to the deciding moment, they were gone. And this is something, I mean, maybe something changed, but you know, you always bring the example of a civilization. I mean, it stays in memory. People are going to look at this and say, well, how can this be the basis for a long-term cooperation? And sure, I get it. In geopolitics, especially, there are no friends. There are just certain interests that exist for a certain time, but at least make the effort or be seen looking like it. I mean, this is one thing that the British always really understood. The fine feeling of at least making the appearance of helping the allies. It doesn't feel like the Americans or at least the current set of geopolitical influences in there have or feel the need to even be there. They're basically drunk on their own power, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the British had all these little phrases and all these little ways of painting the idea of themselves as the fairest dealers in the world. You know, an Englishman's word is bond and all this sort of stuff. i.e., if you make a deal with the British Empire, that they're not gonna renege on it. They'll always follow through and things like that. Now, I'm sure there are times where the British Empire did renege on deals or did the dirty sometimes here or there, but they always try to maintain the appearance of it. Okay, this is why in large parts of the world they were known as the Fox, right? The Americans, up until Trump, did have a pretty robust set of bullshit around how they sold their empire to the world. What Trump has done is he's dropped it, and he's just being like, yeah, it's just hard power now. It's just hard power. And the trouble is that this is not actually very good imperial strategy, because all he's doing is pissing everybody off. When I say he's pissing anyone off, the leaders and, you know, normies and so on. But I've noticed that he's also pissing off large sections of the European right. There's been a huge turn on my timeline. There's been a massive turn. This has been coming for a while. As often is the case, I'm early on these things. I did my run-ins on this sort of stuff about 2 years ago because I saw it coming, right? But the problem is that, how can I say, there's only, like, you can only just rely on this hard power bullying tactic for a short period, because America's strength was its legitimacy, its moral legitimacy, the fact that people wanted to be part of it. You know, I always say the high point of the American Empire was actually when the Berlin Wall came down. You know, the David Hasselhoff concert on the wall, and people, you know, all the big rock and roll and so on. That was the absolute high point of American Empire messaging. You know, the Cold War was over. America had won. Everybody wanted to be part of this story. Trump is telling a story that not only do people not want to be part of it, but also, like, there's no possibility of being part of the story. It's just like, and when you have Matt Walsh, you know, dunking on a Canadian saying, oh, here's the deal, I'm the boss, and we just tell you what to do. Empires can't persist for long if the hegemon is going to carry on in that manner, right? Because it's just going to foster resentment and eventually, you know, nationalism. Now, what is interesting to me is that whether it's deliberate or inadvertent, Trump's strategy of the 5% defense spending increase in Europe, plus him pissing off Europeans, could actually result in conditions where Europe rises again. So this is what, this is why I'm kind of all right with it going on. I've not really gone into any fights over it, because long term, in a way, Trump is weakening America and strengthening Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. I also see this as a huge opportunity for the right. But currently, I see a very big danger of a blue Sulla emerging. Basically, a European or American, it doesn't matter in that sense, guy from the old guard, a optimate in that sense, coming in and basically purging the right, but this time for real. And this is a serious threat, because Trump is basically dipping his toe in the Rubicon, as Yavin said. But it's not really seriously damaging long-term stability of all these patriot networks of the entrenched interests, and it's basically just making him angry. And I mean, currently there's no charismatic leader on their side visible, but, you know, I don't think they have a huge shortage of manpower in that sense. And the thing is, currently they still have to at least have the appearance of the liberal democracy and all the things, all these, well, at least appear to respect privacy rights and human rights and whatever. But I guess this is also eroding, and they're using power more openly over time. And this strengthening may be a possibility for the right, so that general national sentiment is rising. But on the other hand, I also fear the possibility of it and strengthening a blue Sulla, who then, well, I don't think we can have a chat like this after if this happens.
Yeah. So just to flesh out what you're saying is, Trump basically discredits the right,
yep,
internationally or European wide. The Western right is discredited because of Trump and its association with Trump. That kills the right for a generation or something, or 10 years, because it's widely been seen to have resulted in bad stuff, right? And then that gives the pretext to left-wing parties to crack down and become more authoritarian. I mean, at the moment, as we're recording this, Keir Starmer's talking about banning X, right? Seriously. Now, they've given different pretexts for this. One pretext is anti-Semitism, but another pretext is that Grok is generating naked images of, like, female figures, female MPs, and things like that. So they want it. They want to ban X or threaten to ban X if Elon Musk doesn't tweet Grok to stop it making nudie images, basically, right? And oh, the other angle is, what about the children? What about, you know,
like you wouldn't,
yeah. So there's currently a big debate going on in this country, but I'd imagine there are similar debates going on in every European country at the moment as to what to do about X. Now, my position,
and not just that, especially for example, the AfD in Germany, which has in some states a clear or possible. It's not impossible to win in some states. And even nationwide, it has, I think, 40% even is sometimes in some polls the biggest party. So they tried the last 10 years everything to basically crush it. And in the next few years, I think they're going to get two really important angles. The one is the which I just described right now. With the anti-American sentiment of the European establishment. But the other, and this is a mistake that I see a lot of good guys make, they then say, all right, then let's just go the 180, take the 180 degree position and support Russia or whatever. And this is, I think, also a very, very, very dangerous position, because this is then this can be used then to basically say, well, large parts of the AfD are under Russian influence, and we are currently at war with them, so that's why we have to ban them. I think this is a more immediate threat, especially because there were significant cases in AfD history, even recent, where MPs or European Parliament members had taken bribes or are seen waving the Russian flag on protests in Germany and something like this. So this is not just bad optics. It's like a real dangerous game to play, because this is foreign influence counterintelligence operations, they are no joke, and they happen. And if you're caught doing this, then, well, maybe you see sunlight again. And this is not a game. And I think being online and everything, you tend to forget it, but it's not just like about being the most edgy tweeter online or finding the one tweet to rule them all. No, it's there are real consequences involved with even your actions. And
yes,
it's not a game. That's what
It's worth mentioning, by the way, that there's a parallel in this country, because there's been a story that a reform councillor or reform somebody involved with the Reform Party took money from the Russians. So it's a huge talking point on the British left here that Farage is a Russian asset. Right. And now he denies it and all the rest of it. And I think that guy from Reform has been kicked out. But the fact is, the media in this country have made it a talking point. It's a left-wing talking point that Reform are Russia aligned. And it's interesting that in Germany, this parallel tactic is used with the AfD. And also the fact that the Russians were there, in both cases. Yeah, I mean, I would certainly agree. The thing is with the Russians, once you start understanding their talking points and stuff, you do start to realize that they have got quite a lot of anti-European sentiments, and you know, it's like a different. I mean, the term third worldist has been much abused, in my opinion, over the Palestine issue and so on. But there is some genuine, quote unquote, third worldism in Russian talking points, where their strategy is to influence the global South, as they talk about. And, you know, it comes laced with some, you know, sometimes they, when they really get going, some of these guys, they sound like a kind of post-colonialist professor or something. You know what I mean? Like, yep. It's kind of, the Russian position does come laced with all sorts of perils. I mean, the difficult thing is that I don't really support the American empire, right? Especially when it is, you know, working for the interests of some other country, as you well know. Which means that when they get engaged in these entanglements, you kind of find yourself with like, well, you know, Putin does represent some sort of resistance to this hegemony. So in the interest of a kind of like, you know, resisting total takeover, I prefer a situation where the Russians, the Chinese, and their kind of network, the BRICS and so on, have enough strength to resist what the Americans want to do to prevent the unipolar moment reasserting itself, right?
I mean,
this is somewhat different from being a Russia shill. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's a very fine line to walk because on the one hand, it's like Burnham, I think, said, true independence is only found in the cracks between the conflicts of two major empires. Yeah. But the thing is, Russia... supports on the one side the far left in Germany. There's a new left-wing party that split from the old communist party that ruled Eastern Germany. It's called Bündnis Sahra Wagenknecht, basically a left-wing Farage type party. They were shilled as anti-immigration, but it's complete joke. From what I could gather, it's the last hurrah of the old Stasi elite trying to influence German politics, and it was at least not openly fought against by the establishment, because it's a angle of attack against the AfD, because they use they actively push them as anti-immigration left wing, which was it was a complete lie, but it managed to basically pull down a few couple percent on the AfD vote. So that's, I think, a deal they tried to make. And while at the same time, Russia supports far right people. So it's basically the classic double envelopment, trying to. They have basically the same story, just some things left out and others added. So the left wing hears more of the classic third worldist message. Basically, oh, Russia is the anti-imperialist power or whatever. And the right wing hears more like, oh, mu-based Russia and whatever, which is both are complete lies. I mean, Russia is an empire. It's always been an empire. You cannot rule this land and these many different people without being an empire. And on the right story is also a complete lie. It's not a based land. It's in many metrics, not just economically, far worse than European suffering in that sense. They also have huge amounts of immigration. Usually you just don't see it because, well, they have good message control and a huge propaganda operation going on. So it's not our friend, and it's difficult for a true, basically Central European in that sense, to say, okay, what should we even do now? The one side wants to basically completely exploit us and take our resources, and the other does it as well, but maybe a bit nicer. So where do we go from now?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. I don't know if you're familiar with Mackinder and the Mackinder Doctrine.
Yeah.
This was, you know, again, a British imperial or British foreign policy for many, many years to basically drive a wedge between Germany and Russia, keep the state in between Germany and Russia as buffer states, try to keep them neutral, right? That's it, basically. Keep Germany and Russia from forming some sort of alliance. And to me, it's been like that's been the story of the Ukraine war, really. It all comes back down to the bombing of Nord Stream for me, right? That was something that Angela Merkel was working for years. Billions of euros and dollars or whatever were put into that project. You know, there was some rapprochement with Putin. All of that was destroyed by the Ukraine war. And now the prospect of Europe going towards Russia at all has been destroyed for at least another decade or more, because anti-Russian sentiment is very strong, not just in the elite, but also through media and so on, in the people as well. I don't think that is an exaggeration. I think normal people have imbibed a lot of the stuff they got from the media since the Ukraine war. So the prospect of going towards Russia has been destroyed by the Americans. At the same time, as we talked about in the first half of this conversation, the Americans aren't, you know, it's like a dangerous place to be a good friend to them, because they're never good friends. And they haven't been since the end of World War II. So ideally, what needs to happen is that Europe needs to become strong enough eventually to stand on its own feet again, so it can basically just say no to both or play them off against each other. And, you know, there's nothing really, if you have a look at the population of Europe combined, it's bigger than the population of Russia. It's bigger than the population of America.
But this is a
go on, William.
This is a really big question, because yes, you have a big population, but Western Europeans are only like 1/3 of this. So in total, maybe a bit more than 150,000 if you like include Great Britain, France, Germany, and Italy. This is my probably most radical take. I think Mackinder's Heartland theory is deeply flawed. Of course, and on a general view, seeing like, oh, you have this huge land power, if they combine forces, they have resources, manpower and everything, and can be a real danger to a sea power. Of course, yes, on the first glance, it looks like that. And the biggest advantage of such a thing is that you can transfer the resources via land, which completely avoids the interdiction possibility of a sea power, which really troubles British strategic thinkers. And that's probably the reason why it became such a popular thesis in the time it was developed. However, there's one major flaw with it, and that is basically that Western Europeans and Slavic peoples are different, very, very different animals. Americans usually say, well, we are all white and whatever, but it's not really true. They may look white in that sense, but they have a completely different character. Far different than, for example, the difference between Germans and French, or Germans between English. There are noticeable differences even between there, but this is a complete different game. And one thing the British either didn't want to see or had no idea about is how much resources managing Eastern Europe for Germany would have binded, or you know, it just trying to manage Poland from doing rebellions or whatever would have taken so many resources that at least the idea of basically striking out against Britain would have become a ludicrous idea. So I think the biggest strategic blunder of Great Britain was, first of all, in the last century, not staying neutral during World War One, or at least, well, staying out of it. The second one is basically believing the Heartland theory. I mean, I can if you want, I can go deeper into it, but it might deserve its own.
I think it's worth fleshing out this thing you said about Slavs and so on. I mean, what's the difference? Because for a lot of people listening, that they won't know any better. So
it's not that. I mean, let's start with the land. Steppe is a pretty useless land type for the most part. The most productive part in Europe is basically Western Europe along the major rivers, the Rhine and the others, the Danube. And the steppe might have resources and maybe some cattle you can graze there, but on the other hand, it's pretty useless territory, especially in the modern war. Now, then the next thing is the difference between the peoples. There are interesting studies about this, basically when looking at the Ostkolonization of Germans during the medieval age. Wherever you settle Germans, even in the steppes or in the swamps in the middle of Russia, they quickly formed industrial cities. They produced way more than they consumed. They produced not just agricultural goods, but actual industrial goods that you could use for war or whatever. And when you, I think you're familiar with the map, looking before the end of World War II, where you had all these little German enclaves there. These little spots are usually cities of that Germans founded while they were invited by the local land dukes or whatever to basically form industry there. So
sorry to interrupt, but the least likely person I remember reading this in was Thomas Sowell, right? Thomas Sowell's got a whole, but I can't remember which book it is now, where he looks at Germans around the world. And he's like, wherever Germans go, they build stuff. They do really well. You know, they, so there has been quite a lot of academic work on this. Anyway, go on. Yeah.
And the major difference between the Germans and, for example, the tribe is that best example is America. At least 40% of immigration into America came from Germany from at some point, but they never really truly built an independent elite class vying for power. They just went into the West, colonized the West, did their stuff, and basically failed to build a own power base because it's not really, you could say it's not really in our nature or whatever. It doesn't really matter. What matters is, other than, for example, when the tribes get invited in, you don't immediately have a rival elite faction trying to wrestle the power away. It might come many, many generations down the line because such such conflicts always happen when you have two radically different ethnicities living next to each other. But usually, the whole arrangement worked for centuries, 500 centuries, even more, perfectly fine, as long as you had German cities and Slavic lands around it. The only problem started during the 19th century when you had the development of nationalism going over there, so that it was basically, this land must now be completely either Slavic or either Germanic. And this really boiled up all the conflict over there. And in that sense, going back to the heartland theory, you can maybe get resources out of there. Okay, this is a given, but you still have to manage all of these different peoples over there, and they're widely different. For example, you cannot approach a Polish guy the same as you do a Baltic. There's a very small geographic difference or distance, but a huge difference in character. And this is also something I talked about with Vulpes. I don't know if you know him, at the last Karlstage. We were talking about the medium-term future in Europe, and he said, well, France is probably going to take the lead in the European Union in the medium-term future. And I said, yes, this is completely right, because they have some, they are more independent than, for example, Germany. However, they have one thing that will, in the long term, prevent them from really taking the lead in Europe for a long time. It's that they usually lack the capacity to reach a compromise or really try to, well, get into the mind of the guy on the other side. It's usually the French way or no way. You see it with every time Europe tries to develop a military product or whatever. For example, it doesn't matter if it's tanks or airplanes. Germany, Britain, Italy, whatever, they find a compromise. The only guy who always has to make his own thing and leaves everybody else hanging is France, because their mindset is basically, well, it's our way or no way. Mm-hmm. The Germans, because we live in the center, we have the steppe to our east, and we have Western Germany or the Western powers to our west. We had to develop a mindset that says, okay, how do we reach a compromise? Because like fighting constant wars in the steppes it can't work. You're just gonna bleed out, and this is why for the long term, Central Europe needs a German leadership. I'm not just saying that because I'm a German and I, you know, ethnic nepotism. It's just, if you want to have a stable ruling class, how things worked for hundreds of years, during the whole medieval time, to right until up to the waves of nationalism at the 19th century, it basically was local population managed by a German ruling class. And this used to be really stable. The thing is, well, we live in modern times. How can this be, is it even valid this century? I don't know. But I'm just looking back at how things were, how they worked, and trying to deduct things that could work for the future. Mm. And the European way currently, that the current elite are trying to foster nationalism of European kind or whatever, is basically, yeah, we're all equals, we're all one European family, and it's not going to work. It's going to...
Thinking in a Machiavellian way, though, because I remember all the Brexit debates and so on, and in this country, this is going to sound so strange to look back on, but a lot of the Brexit right, Tory types, right, would sell their opposition to the European Union by saying that it's secretly a rearticulation of the Third Reich, that the EU is the Fourth Reich, right? Now, I'm serious now, right? And there were all of these memes that used to do the rounds of Angela Merkel with a little moustache and things like this, okay? Boomer right type net talking points. Yeah. But the idea was is that no matter what the actual leaders say, secretly, Germany is the leader of Europe and the leader of the EU de facto. And that the French may talk a good game, but when push comes to shove, everybody knows Germany is the manufacturing superpower. Germany is the base. When they made the euro, the Deutschmark was the base currency that all the others had to base themselves from, and so on. So there was a lot of talk then that the EU project is a German project. My question to you is, okay, let's say the European leaders are using the rhetoric of equality and so on to sell the idea. Wouldn't it still be true that under the hood, it's still basically a German project?
I mean, I wish it was true. Especially Polish propaganda of the PiS party is basically this. So their whole anti-European narrative is, well, it's the Fourth Reich. But it's not true in the sense that we don't have an elite class that actively wants to pursue German interests. They might do it by accident, but they are so beaten and so self-hating that the whole idea that the current Germanic European ruling class basically tries to build another empire is completely laughable because they hate themselves so much. They were trained to do it. And I mean, honestly speaking, I wish it were true, but it's just not. And how it usually works, and I think if they continue the current course, it will become even more so. France is basically taking the glory, and they're going to demand French language everywhere and everything, and it's going to be the French way. Germany's going to pay the bill, and smaller nations are going to, I think, try to block everything they can, or try to insert their own interests above the whole group interest, and it's going to be just chaos. The Austrian Empire, for example, descended into chaos because the whole idea of being an empire with different ethnicities in there that might have their own little cultures, that might have their own little enclaves or whatever, it broke down and became the everybody for themselves kind of mentality. And the current European project is fostering the latter. It's not fostering the imperial idea. Or you don't need to call it empire, but the idea of a unified Europe cannot work unless you have at least a figurehead to what everybody can look at and say, or at least he's going to make a just decision. Otherwise, it cannot work.
But caught between Russia and America, would you agree that Europe as a power block needs to come together and be like, look, whatever happened in the past between the Italians and the Germans and the Spanish and the French, Britain's out of Europe now in theory, but even I would include the British in this long term, okay? Isn't it time to just say, like, look, whatever happened in the past, happened in the past. This is a different moment now. And if we don't put our differences aside and actually unify and actually work out a coherent strategy, we're going to be buggered in the next century.
Yeah.
They talk about the Chinese century of humiliation in the 19th century. It feels like Europe is currently living through its century of humiliation. Yeah. The only way out of it is to put aside, like, in a way, to put aside what Mark Braman would call petty nationalism and be like, look, we have to do this European federalism. Otherwise, we're buggered. These two different powers are just going to flood these nations with foreigners, and Europe will be no more in 100 years or something.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And there are certain, I've traveled a lot around Europe for business or for private reasons. And there are certain areas where this exactly works. For example, especially with Great Britain, I've been there to a couple of VTEN events, and talking to the people there, you especially get this feeling. World War II wasn't a great idea, but right now we're in this predicament together, and there's no other way. We basically have to say, all right, maybe the Germans with their directness are a bit weird, or maybe the British with their sensibilities are a bit weird. Oh, okay, but right now we're in a really difficult situation. This works usually with the British, with Italians, with Spanish, or whatever, and sometimes even French. However, one part where I've always revolved back into very how would you call it ankle biting nationalism is especially in Poland. It's not coming from a point of basically of hate or something. It's just I've traveled a lot there. I went even to Polish weddings and something. So I wish it could work, but it will always devolve down into something like this. And
the Poles are going to be an issue. I have a book here called Europe. Where is it? This one. Right, by Norman Davis. And reading that, he re-centers Europe on Poland a lot more. Like, i.e. the centrality of Poland in and Eastern Europe in general. Because I think the way we're taught history, obviously, is first British-centric, but then it's Western Europe-centric as well. But what he does in that book is he kind of re-centers it. And it's like, that is going to be a difficult sticking point. And interestingly, the Americans are already in there. I mean, I see Poland as a proxy American empire frontier nation. I think that's the correct way to view it in the current terms, because that's what they're using it for. They're using it as the wedge against Russia for NATO, but also as the bulwark against any kind of European solidarity, right? Because from the American point of view, there's a danger, because Europe could become a rival castle, and I think Ukraine is all about smashing that possibility. But it is something that is going to have to be overcome if Europe is going to have any sort of future.
Yeah, it's a really difficult question. For example, a personal anecdote, I've traveled quite a lot in the Baltic states, and there you get a really different sense of how they even approach the German common history, because for many centuries you had a lot of Germans living there, you had German ruling classes or the Hanse having enclaves and cities there, and they approach it really chill, to use the modern word. It's like, yeah, it happens. There were good things, there were bad things. It just is. And let's just work together. But I wish it were different. But there was a time where I approached this topic completely differently. But the more I had to do with especially right-wing Polish parties, there's really little hope I have, because it's the exact same position they're in as they were in the Second World War, where they had a distant ally far away that's basically supporting their ethnic nepotism in that sense, or their strange ideas with Intermarium or whatever, saying, yeah, we're on your side. You can basically bark as loud as you want. We will be there when you're in trouble. But just logistically speaking, it's going to be a really, really hard time for Poland if Russia really decides to do something about the Suwalki Gap, or if the EU is getting fed up with their stupid games. It is a difficult situation we're in, and I just hope that we have sensible people in listening here that can actually make a difference and go back to like the way, or at least an honest approach to it. It doesn't matter if you want anti-imperialism, or you want empire, or you are a democratic person or whatever. There are certain realities happening, especially in Central Europe and Eastern Europe, that you just cannot wish away, and that will always persist, and have been the trouble for centuries, even millennia. So trying to just say, yeah, we have technology now, and we're just going to use the internet and some magic, it's not going to work.
Just before we wrap up here, do you think it was a mistake by the European Union to accept the Eastern European nations in? Because I remember in this country, that was one of the kind of sticking points for the Eurosceptic crowd, which ultimately led to Brexit, was that they let all of these post-Cold War Eastern Bloc countries in, right? Which obviously, you know, massive, like, okay, you could say, well, it increased GDP, but it also massively decreased GDP per capita. And also, in terms of internal migration, means you've got all these people in these Eastern Bloc countries who are massively poorer than the ones in the West. But now, because of Schengen and whatever, they can just move wherever they want. Mm. It was a huge controversy when it happened. People don't talk about, people, I think, have come to accept it now. But do you think it was a mistake to allow the Eastern Europeans to become part of the European Union?
I mean, the European Union would have been way more successful if you had basically a two-tiered system, basically Britain, France, Germany, and maybe even Italy being like the first tier, having like a very strong integration into each other economically, maybe even same currency. But other countries that have way weaker economies and everything, they should have probably been like a second tier, or I don't know how we would call it, but basically similar, basically a same alliance, but like not completely integrated. Mm-hmm. The only thing, and this was also one of the biggest reasons because why Germany even supported the euro idea, is the Deutsche Mark had a lot of pressure applied on it because Germany exported a lot. So because we had our own very strong currency, the exports were really expensive. As soon as the euro came in, the exports flooded out, and we didn't have the Deutschmark pressure again. So this was, at least in short term, a very big boost for the German economy. But in the long term, it might have, well, sealed our collapse or something. We will see.
All right. So it's been a very interesting conversation. It is a tight spot for Europe right now. One of the things that is unhelpful from Americans, that their instinct, for some reason, the American chud, is at this moment to stick the boot in, right? Hmm. These are the same people who talk all the time about, like, you know, the white race and all this, and they're like sticking the boot in. What do you think you're doing? You know, this is where all those memes come from. But it's like, well, can the Americans have to be seen as something different? I think ultimately, because it's like you can't seriously have the view that you have solidarity with Europeans and then carry on like that, right? You know what I mean? Because clearly, what they're doing is counter to European interests and European people, more importantly. So I don't really understand that, and it fosters a lot of ill will, and it has done. I think you're also right that certainly in the short term, at the very least, getting too close to the Russians presents a real danger for people in the current moment, because I think it will be used correctly as a pretext to take action against those people and possibly even lock them up.
Yeah, and I would even argue that even long term, there's not much to gain from a alliance with Russia. But I guess then we get into a historical discussion that could take another hour. So yeah, maybe a different time.
At the very least, would you not think that some form of entente, or what do they used to call it in the Cold War, peaceful coexistence or something, with the Russian? Because otherwise you're going to be in a war footing with the Russians forever.
I guess that. Now, the thing is, we have all, this has always been the way, especially now with the, Russia is still basically ruled by the former KGB elite. Putin and his friends are all former KGB officers. And even back then, the so-called peaceful coexistence was still full of KGB subversion in Western countries. Of course, you could say, yeah, the CIA did the same. Okay, maybe, but they weren't really effective with it, or maybe they didn't even do the same effort with it. So I guess peaceful coexistence can only happen through a position of strength, of saying basically, well, you have to peacefully coexist with us now, or you just get steamrolled. And we basically right now we're in the inferior position because we had the so-called years of lead. It's something a right-wing German guy coined. Basically, the early 2000s, late 90s were a heavy time for anybody seriously thinking about geopolitical strategy outside of the Fukuyama frame, because the American dominance, full spectrum dominance, was so heavy that any discussion was basically either seen as pointless or so distant in the future that, well, it's not an issue right now. Maybe our grandchildren have to deal with it. Well, the time approached faster than everybody could expect it. And now we're in a position of saying, well, we really need a military right now. I hope it will be a chance for genuine right-wing interest of saying, okay, well, with strengthening our military, we have to get back to sensible ways of thinking about the world. No more feminist foreign policy. I'm not kidding. Yeah. This was a former foreign minister. This was her stated goal. And we have to get back to men in the room, of sensible people in the room, dealing with realities and not just some castles in the sky.
Well, I mean, we've been going long, but this is a very interesting discussion. One of the things, you know, we talked about earlier on, I mentioned that Keir Starmer was talking about banning X. Now, this may seem counterintuitive, but I want that to happen. I think that would be the best thing to happen for people engaging with politics, period, is just to ban X. Because to me, it's become clear that X, especially since Elon Musk take over, it was always this to an extent, but certainly since Musk, has become a foreign influence operation.
Hmm.
Right? Whatever that configuration is of the Zionist American power, clearly X is currently geared towards pushing that as a message. Right? It's geared, the algorithm, everything is geared towards, and it's become super obvious since, you know, Trump has taken fairly unpopular actions on Venezuela, and, you know, there's been this recent thing in Iran and so on. You can just tell that X is now configured in such a way that, you know, certain lines are being pushed. Okay.
Yeah.
I think that those powers have got a long-term plan to basically create mini Trumps in each of our nations, right? With a mini Trump in Britain, a mini Trump in Germany, and so on and so forth. And we know what Trump is now. And so I actually just think it would be good from the point of view of sovereignty, even though it's happening under the liberal rubric or the left-wing rubric, right? I still think it would be beneficial for X to be banned. But you try telling that to 99% of people on the right and they'll think you were mad.
I mean, honestly, I'm neutral on it. I had great time on Twitter, especially back in 2022 when there was still an honest discussion going on. And it was before the invasion of the Indian slop. But currently, I also exactly see what you say. On the one hand, from the source of the source code, you have a very obvious waiting in a certain direction, while at the same time, you have immense Russian slop propaganda that is basically flooding the whole discourse, also in Germany. So it's basically, again, a double whammy. And one metric, at least one thing that I can say that was good about Twitter, you really got to see how people react when they are forced to make a decision, or not really forced, but can make a decision. And one thing I liked, or well, could filter there, was people that didn't immediately jump to conclusions or try to make the next slop post to an engagement farm. They were the ones that were worth staying in contact with. That there are many good friends you found on Twitter that at some point you found or met at a VTN event at the Karlstag or whatever. And this is basically the only good thing that happened from it. The whole engagement slop, I mean, it's also one thing that might get a bit into the next topic, but a modern superpower the next modern superpower is going to be the one that limits cell phones for its population. And right now, if you can train your algorithm that the algorithm works for you, basically it's no slop posting, constantly saying not interested, not interested, not interested in slop, and basically only engaging with good content in that sense, then you can create a very useful tool. But most people don't have the will or the capacity to do that. So, yeah.
All right. Well, it's been a very interesting conversation. Where can people find you?
Well, usually on Twitter or YouTube. We have a YouTube channel that does some interviews in English. Recently, we did a stream with Wulpes about the NGO networks of the European Union. If you're into that, watch this. And then we do other podcast episodes of book readings, interesting episodes, and other interesting talks about music, history, and everything a sensible, centrist young guy might find enjoyable.
Many sensitive, young, sensible centrists in Germany and in Britain. So, yeah, check him out. And I will just remind people, promo code SHORJAN, 25% off all courses. And we'll catch you next time. Go on, get out, everybody. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.